This week, we're going to spend an hour on a single number, 73%, and what a school does when it treats that number as proof. The story underneath it is a freshman in Wake County, North Carolina, who turned in an English assignment and got back an accusation. A detector said her writing was machine-made. The grade and the suspicion followed. Here's what keeps nagging at me. We have spent 2 years arguing about whether the chatbots are dangerous, whether they're overhyped, whether they'll take our jobs, and meanwhile, quietly, a second category of tool moved into the classroom. The tool that claims to catch the first one. And nobody asked that second tool to prove itself the way we've asked everything else to prove itself. A detector that is right roughly 3 out of 4 times is being read aloud in disciplinary hearings as though it were a fingerprint. What troubles me is not that the machine is imperfect. Everything is imperfect. What troubles me is that the conversation around it has gotten more comfortable as the evidence has gotten worse. That inversion is the thing I want to sit inside for the next hour. You're listening to Tertulia, the I conversation, slowed down. This week we're talking about the false positive crisis in I detection, the software that promises to tell teacher-graded prose from machine-generated prose, the students who've been wrongly flagged by it, and the strange way the discourse around these tools has learned to sound reasonable about being wrong. Our written edition this week ran a column called 73% is not proof. We've all read it. We're not going to read it back to you. We're going to argue with it, extend it, and in a couple of places, I suspect, disagree with it. Let me bring the room in. Let me introduce who's at the table, not by their resumes, but by what's been occupying them lately. To my left, someone who has spent the better part of the last decade reading the literature on algorithmic decision making in high-stakes settings, sentencing, welfare, hiring. And who keeps muttering that we've seen this exact movie before? What's been on your mind this week?
The word peace, honestly. The trade press has settled on this phrase, making peace with eye detectors, and I cannot stop turning it over, because in every prior wave of this, with risk assessment tools in the courts, with predictive policing, the institutions also eventually arrived at a kind of peace. Peace, it turns out, is what you call it when the people absorbing the errors don't have a seat at the table. So I've been thinking about how old this is, and how each generation discovers it as if it were new.
We'll come back to that movie, across from you, someone who reads across disciplines and is comfortable saying when she doesn't know, which is rarer than it sounds. What's pulling at you?
The arithmetic, mostly. I keep getting stuck on the gap between an accuracy number and what it actually means at the scale of a school district. 73% sounds almost respectable in the abstract. It sounds like a B-, but the moment you run it across tens of thousands of honest essays, the wrongly accused stop being an anecdote and become a population. And I'm not fully sure yet how to talk about that in a way that lands, because people's intuition about percentages just collapses at scale. So I've been worrying at that.
Next to her, the person in this room who actually has to make these decisions inside real institutions, who works with universities and ministries where the budget is small and the pressure is large.
And where the detector is in English, and most of my students are not writing in their first language. So when the column mentions that non-native English writers get flagged at disproportionately high rates, for me that is not a line in a study. That is Tuesday. That is a face in my office. So what I've been carrying this week is the distance between the people writing these columns, who I love, and the procurement officer in a public university in my region who has $40 per student per year, and a vendor telling him this tool will solve his integrity problem. I want both of those people in this conversation.
And finally, the person whose job at this table is to not let any of us get away with anything. What's your starting posture?
Suspicious of our own side, frankly. The column is very good, and I agree with most of it, which is exactly when I get nervous. There's a 73% figure doing an enormous amount of load-bearing work in that piece, and across the whole trade conversation, and I want to know where it comes from before we build a cathedral on it. Independent studies, aggregated, real-world accuracy around 73. Fine, but aggregated how? across which tools, which student populations, which kinds of text, because I've watched too many arguments get won by a number that nobody actually interrogated. So before I'm angry on behalf of anyone, I want to be sure the number deserves my anger.
Good. That's the room. Let me lay the phenomenon out plainly for anyone who's come to this fresh, and then I want each of you to react to the framing rather than to me. When generative writing tools arrived in classrooms, there was a panic, a real one. I don't want to minimize it. Teachers genuinely did not know how to tell whether the essay in front of them had been written by the student or generated in 15 seconds. And into that panic walked a category of software that said, "We can tell. Paste the text, read the percentage, act on it." The promise was that you could convert a vague civilizational dread into a manageable classroom procedure. The column's argument is that the promise was false in a specific, measurable way, and this is the sharper claim, that the discourse around the tools has matured in its rhetoric, while the tools themselves have barely improved. The talk got wiser. The machine stayed the same. Who wants to take the first swing at that framing?
I'll start by complicating it. The framing assumes the rhetoric and the tool are moving independently, talk improving, machine static, but there's a third actor. The generators themselves are moving. The thing the detector is trying to catch is a moving target. So when we say the detector hasn't improved, we should be careful. Improved relative to what? If the generators got dramatically better at sounding human over the same period, then a detector standing still is actually falling behind even to hold a constant accuracy number. That's not a defense of the tools. It's just to say the static machine picture might be too kind to the machine, not too harsh.
That's a good point, and it actually makes the whole enterprise look worse, not better, because it means the accuracy figure isn't even a stable property of the tool. It's a snapshot of an arms race at one moment. A vendor can publish 98% accuracy in a press release, and that number can be true in a lab against last year's generator and meaningless against what a student can access this morning. So the number isn't just inflated, it has a half-life.
Which is precisely the structure of the Compass story, if I may.
He got there in under 4 minutes. I had a bet with myself.
I'm going to earn it. Give me a moment. The risk assessment tool that the newsroom ProPublica audited, used in Florida courts to advise judges on parole and sentencing. The finding there was not that it was inaccurate in some flat, overall sense. The vendor could and did point to an aggregate accuracy that looked defensible. The finding was that the errors had a shape. The false positives, people predicted to reoffend who did not, fell disproportionately on black defendants. The false negatives fell the other way. And the lesson, the one that has not aged a day, is that a system's mistakes are never neutrally scattered. They land on someone in particular. And the people they land on are almost never the people who chose to switch the system on.
So your claim is the detector is Compass in a new room?
The detector is Compass in a new room with worse oversight, because at least the courts eventually got a journalistic audit. A high school disciplinary committee gets a percentage on a screen and a teacher who was tired.
Can I push on the room metaphor, though? Because I think the room matters enormously, and we keep treating it as interchangeable. In a court, in principle, there is a defense. There is an adversarial process. It fails often, but it exists. In a high school integrity hearing, in many of the places I work, there is no defense. There is a student. Frequently a frightened 16-year-old, frequently writing in a second language against a teacher and a number. There is no lawyer. There is sometimes no appeal. The asymmetry is not the same asymmetry. It is worse because the venue is smaller and quieter and has less scrutiny. And a small, quiet venue is exactly where a bad tool can do the most damage without anyone writing a ProPublica investigation about it.
Say more about the second language piece, because the column leans hard on it, and I want to make sure we've got the mechanism right, not just the outcome.
The mechanism, as I understand it, is that a detector is keying on properties of text that correlate with machine generation. Low surprise, regularity, a certain smoothness, predictable word choices. Now think about how a competent but non-native writer composes in English. They reach for safer constructions. They use the phrasings they're confident are correct. They avoid the idiom and the risk that a native writer throws in casually. The result is prose that is more regular, more formulaic, not because a machine wrote it, but because writing in a second language under pressure produces exactly that kind of careful, smoothed-out text. So the very effort of writing well in a language that isn't yours produces the signal the detector reads as fraud. The student's diligence is the evidence against her.
And there's a version of that for native speakers too, which I think gets lost. Anyone writing in a constrained, formal register, a nervous student trying to sound academic, a student who learned to write from templates, a neurodivergent student with a very systematic style, they all drift toward the same regularity. The detector isn't detecting machines, it's detecting a particular texture of caution. And caution is unevenly distributed across exactly the populations that are already the most precarious.
I want to register that I find this persuasive, and I still want the numbers behind it, because disproportionately high is the sort of phrase that can mean 3 percentage points or 30, and the moral weight is completely different depending on which.
There's a useful image for the mechanism, though, regardless of the magnitude. There's a researcher who writes about machine learning with a great deal of humor. The example I'm thinking of is an image classifier that was supposed to recognize a particular fish, a tench, and the system learned to recognize it beautifully, except it turned out it hadn't learned the fish at all. It had learned to look for human fingers against a green background, because nearly every photo of that fish in the training data was an angler holding up his catch outdoors. The model was confident, and it was wrong in a perfectly patterned way. It had learned a correlate of the thing instead of the thing.
It was finding fingers, not fish.
It was finding fingers, not fish. And a detector that flags second language phrasing as synthetic has made the tench's mistake exactly. It is not detecting machine authorship. It is detecting a correlate, regularity, caution, smoothness, that happens in the training data and in the world to travel alongside machine authorship and also alongside a perfectly honest human writing carefully in a language not her own.
Let me zoom out for a second, because I want to make sure we've named why this is the week to talk about it. The Wake County case is real. It's recent. The student petitioned her district for actual rules. But the column's argument is that the case is a node in a pattern, not the pattern itself. Why now? What changed?
What changed is that the cases stopped being isolated and started being a category. A single false accusation is a tragedy for one family. A documented, repeated pattern with lawsuits attached is a policy problem. We have crossed from the first to the second, and institutions are now being forced to write down their rules, which means the implicit assumptions are becoming explicit and contestable. That's the moment. When you have to write the policy, you have to admit what the tool is.
I'd add that what changed is the vendors blinked. The shift from we can tell to here is how to live responsibly with the fact that we sometimes can't. That's a retreat, and retreats are revealing. You don't reposition a product from solution to manageable condition unless the original claim became untenable. So now is the moment, partly because the people selling these tools quietly stopped promising what they used to promise, and we should hold them to the earlier promise, not the convenient new humility.
That tension, the convenient, new humility, is exactly where I want to spend Act 2. Because the column's central move is about how the conversation itself changed shape over the last 18 months. And I want to trace that arc carefully before we start throwing punches at it. Hold your positions. So let's do the longitudinal work. The column tells a story about how the discourse around these tools evolved. And crucially, it argues the discourse evolved in the wrong direction relative to the evidence. Walk me through the arc as you each remember it, and I fully expect you to remember it differently. Start us back at the beginning, late 2024. What was the register?
Awe shadowed by dread. That was the dominant key. The technology was advancing faster than most of us can comprehend. That's nearly a direct quote from the trade press of that moment. And the public was invited to feel fascination and fear in roughly equal measure. And in that climate, a detection tool had an almost irresistible appeal, not because of what it did technically, but because of what it offered emotionally. It promised to take a vast, formless civilizational anxiety and shrink it down to a procedure you could perform before lunch. Paste, read, act. The relief was the product. The detection was almost incidental.
I remember it slightly differently, actually. I don't think the early register was pure awe and dread. I think there were two separate panics that got conflated. There was the existential one, the will this end civilization one, and there was a much more mundane, much more administrative panic, which was, my grading model is broken, and I don't know how to assign an essay anymore. And the detector spoke to the second panic, not the first. It wasn't relieving cosmic dread. It was relieving a very specific professional embarrassment, which is that a teacher had built a career on the take-home essay, and the take-home essay had just stopped working overnight.
I'd accept that as a refinement rather than a disagreement.
I think it's a little more than a refinement, because it changes who the tool was for. If it was relieving cosmic dread, it was for the public. If it was relieving professional embarrassment, it was for the institution specifically, and that matters for the whole argument about who bears the cost. The detector was never a consumer product. It was an institutional comfort object from day one.
That's a genuine difference, and I want to mark it rather than resolve it. Hold both. What happened next?
Next, the reality check arrived, and not for detectors specifically, but for the whole sector. Across the first half of 2025, there was this rising willingness in the trade press to ask whether any of these products did what their makers said. People started using the phrase A-washing. The practice of taking ordinary software, slapping the word intelligent on it, and inflating the price and the claims. There was an engineer, 15 years in the field, writing very plainly about the telltale signs of it, and by summer, it had hardened into something like a public interest argument that audiences were being bombarded with positive messaging and needed to learn to challenge what One Piece called the good A myth that the companies were pushing.
And that's the crucial sequencing point. The skepticism that detectors would eventually face was first rehearsed on the industry as a whole. The general scrutiny came first. The specific scrutiny of detectors arrived later, inheriting a vocabulary that had already been developed for catching exaggerated claims. So by the time people turned to the detectors with a critical eye, they had the conceptual tools ready.
Right, but here's where I think the column is doing something a little too neat. It treats the general skepticism as a kind of moral high watermark. The conversation was getting appropriately suspicious of the whole sector, and then it treats what happened to detectors specifically as a fall from that grace, a relapse into accommodation. And I'm not certain the two were the same wave. The general A-washing critique was about money. It was about investors and valuations and whether the financial story held up. The detector conversation was about students. Those are different stakes and possibly different communities of people talking. I'm wary of stitching them into one continuous arc just because they rhyme.
That's a sharp objection. Does the arc actually connect, or are we pattern matching?
I think it half connects. The skill transferred. People learned to say, show me the independent number, not the vendor number. But the audience and the stakes shifted underneath it. So you get this strange situation where the same critical vocabulary gets deployed, but in the service of a much gentler conclusion. In the financial critique, the conclusion was this company is overvalued, sell. In the detector critique, the conclusion became this tool is imperfect, mitigate. Same suspicion, much softer verdict. And I think that softening is the actual phenomenon, and it doesn't require the two waves to be the same wave. It just requires the verdict to lose its teeth as it moved from money to children.
and I think the verdict lost its teeth because of who was holding it. When you critique a company's valuation, the person on the other side is an investor, someone with power, someone you're comfortable being harsh with. When you critique a classroom tool, the trade press suddenly remembers there's a tired teacher on the other side who is trying her best, and it gets gentle because nobody wants to scold the teacher. But in being gentle to the teacher, the conversation became gentle to the tool, and the student disappeared from the frame entirely. The softening wasn't cowardice. It was misplaced compassion, aimed at the institution instead of the kid.
So now we get to the phrase the whole column is built around, making peace.
Making peace with AI detectors in schools. And the column is right to sit with that phrasing because it does an extraordinary amount of quiet work. You make peace with a difficult neighbor, with a chronic illness, with a fact of nature, the weather, mortality. You do not make peace with a faulty instrument that you are entirely free to put down. The metaphor smuggles in a premise before any argument is made that the tool is permanent, inevitable, a condition of the world rather than a procurement choice. And once you've accepted permanence, the only remaining question is adjustment. How do we live with it? Never should we.
I'll grant the rhetorical analysis is elegant. I'll even grant it's mostly correct. But I want to flag that there's a reading of making peace that's more sympathetic. And we should at least try it on. It might mean stop pretending you can ban these things. Students have the generators. The cat is out of the bag. Detectors are flawed, but they're part of a messy reality. And a mature educator stops fantasizing about a return to 1995 and figures out how to operate in the actual conditions. On that reading, making peace isn't surrender to the tool. It's surrender to reality, which is a different and more defensible thing.
But notice the slide in that sympathetic reading. You started with making peace with the unbannable existence of generators, which, fine, that's just true, and you ended with making peace with the detectors, which are a specific, optional, purchasable response to that reality. Those are not the same beast. One is accepting the weather, the other is accepting a particular bad umbrella that a salesman is holding. The phrase works precisely by letting you slide from the first to the second without noticing you've changed objects.
That's good. That's the strongest version of the column's point, and I concede it. The phrase launders the inevitability of generators into the inevitability of detectors. They are not the same inevitability.
There's a second register, the column names alongside making peace. The question mark genre, are detectors really serving students? Tell me about that one.
Ah, the double-edged sword. This is the genre I find most quietly corrosive, honestly, because it sounds so fair. The headline poses a question. Are these tools really serving students? And the question mark itself does the damage. It signals concern. It performs balance. But it defers the verdict indefinitely. It invites you to weigh two edges of a sword as if the weighing never has to end, as if you can hold the question open forever. While, in the meantime, the tool keeps running and the students keep getting flagged, the open question becomes an alibi for continued use. We're still studying it. We're still weighing it. And every day you're weighing it, the machine is deciding.
This is the house style of the entire responsible A conversation, and it predates these tools by years. The posture that every harm is a trade-off and every trade-off is, in principle, balanceable. It sounds so reasonable. It sounds like maturity. But it has a hidden assumption, which is that both sides of the trade are commensurable, that the institution's efficiency and the student's wrongful accusation can be placed on the same scale and balanced against each other. And they can't. They're held by different people. You can't balance my convenience against your wrongful punishment and call the result fair. Because I'm not the one paying.
Now here's the part of the arc that I find genuinely surprising, and I want to make sure listeners catch it. The column claims the valence inverted. Walk me through that.
This is the most counterintuitive finding, and I think it's the strongest thing in the piece. Through 2024 and early 2025, the detector topic surfaced only occasionally, and when it did, the critical framings slightly outnumbered the optimistic ones. People were a little more likely to be worried than reassured. Then, from the second quarter of 2025 onward, the topic got loud, much more volume, and you'd expect, naturally, that as the evidence of harm accumulated, the worry would grow. The opposite happened. As the topic got louder, the reassuring framings pulled ahead. The making peace and are they serving students registers started outnumbering the flatly critical one. So the discourse got more accommodating, exactly as the evidence got worse. That's the rhetorical event of the whole arc. The conversation moved against its own evidence.
And this is where my professional suspicion fires hardest, because that's a measurement claim, and I want to know how it was measured. Critical framings slightly outnumbered, then optimistic framings pulled ahead. Who coded these? What counts as optimistic? Because making peace could be coded as optimistic accommodation, sure, but it could equally be coded as resigned pessimism. Are they serving students with a question mark? Is that optimistic or critical? It reads to me as anxious, not reassuring. So I worry the inversion is partly an artifact of how the framings got bucketed. I believe something shifted. I'm not sure the shift is as clean as evidence. Got worse, discourse. Got happier.
That's fair, and I'll be honest. I can't fully defend the coding because I didn't do it. What I'd say is that even if the precise direction of the inversion is contestable, the absence of escalation is not. At minimum, the discourse did not get more alarmed as the cases mounted. And for a topic where the evidence was accumulating in one direction, more false positives, more lawsuits, more documented harm to a vulnerable population, the conversation staying flat is itself remarkable. You'd expect alarm to track evidence. It didn't. Whether it actively softened or merely failed to sharpen, either way the discourse decoupled from the evidence. And that decoupling is the thing.
There's a corrective to all of this from the older literature that I think earns its place here. There's a journalist who wrote a book about how computers misunderstand the world. She talks about projects in journalism and academia that were trying, even years ago, to put a more balanced view of these systems on the horizon. Institutions founded specifically to interrogate the tools being sold as neutral. And the key thing about her sense of balanced is that it is not the trade press's sense of balanced. The trade press means split the difference between the vendor and the victim, land in the reasonable middle. Her balanced means something almost opposite. Refuse to grant a technology the benefit of the doubt it has not earned. Make it prove itself before you trust it. Those are two completely different operations wearing the same word.
That's a beautiful distinction, and I want to make sure we hold it. Two meanings of balance.
Two meanings, and the detector conversation has been performing the first while borrowing the credibility of the second. It sounds rigorous and even-handed. It's wearing the costume of skepticism. But underneath, it's doing the splitting, the difference move, which always, structurally, favors the party that's already deployed. Because the default, while you split the difference, is that the tool keeps running.
Here's where I land. That doesn't fully resolve with him, and I think it's worth leaving unresolved. I agree the trade press is doing the cheap balance, but I'm not willing to say the expensive balance. The refuse to trust it stance is automatically right either, because there's a failure mode on that side too, which is the reflexive refusal to ever trust any tool, which would have you reject things that genuinely work alongside the things that don't. The detectors may well deserve refusal, but I want the refusal to come from the specific evidence about these specific tools, not from a general posture of never trust the machine. Otherwise, we've just replaced one cheap reflex with another.
I think we genuinely differ there, and I'm content to let us differ. My position is that for tools that make adverse decisions about individual people, the burden of proof should sit so heavily on the tool that a general posture of skepticism is the correct default, not a reflex to apologize for. You think that's too blunt?
I think it's too blunt, as a general law. For this specific tool, in this specific use, I suspect we agree on the outcome. But I won't pretend the principle is settled, because I don't think it is.
Good. That's a real disagreement, and we're going to leave it standing. The two of you don't agree on whether refuse to trust is a default or a conclusion. And I don't think this hour is going to settle it. Let me bring in something the column does that I want us to examine. It reaches back to the publication's own prior work. There was a briefing in September last year about the social aspects of these systems, about how tools sold as enhancing inclusion reproduce the exclusions they claim to dissolve. Does the detector fit that prior frame, or does it break it?
It fits it almost too perfectly, which makes me slightly nervous, because when a case fits your prior theory perfectly, you should check whether you're seeing clearly or just confirming yourself. But the fit is real. The detector is marketed, ultimately, in the language of fairness. We will ensure academic integrity. We will create a level playing field. The honest students deserve protection from the cheaters. That's an inclusion argument. And the mechanism produces a new exclusion. It disproportionately misfires on the non-native writers, on the cautious, on the precarious. So you have a fairness tool generating unfairness with a clean technical alibi. That is exactly the structure the September piece named.
But I want to be careful not to just restate last September. The prior piece said roughly A's benefits for justice are conditional on mitigating bias and ensuring equitable access. And if all we do this week is say C, the detector confirms that we've added nothing. The delta this week, the new thing, is that the detector isn't a case where the bias is a bug to be mitigated. The bias is structurally inseparable from the function. The tool works by detecting regularity, and second language regularity is real regularity. So there is no version of the tool that detects machine regularity without also flagging human second language regularity, because to the tool they are the same signal. So this isn't conditional on mitigation. You can't mitigate your way out of it. The defect is the design. That's the new claim, and it's stronger than the September one.
That's an important escalation. Last year, the move was, with the right guardrails, these tools can serve justice. This week, the move is, for this particular tool, there are no guardrails that fix it, because the fairness violation is not in the implementation, it's in the operating principle.
That's a meaningful sharpening of the House position, and I want to make sure we credit it as a change, not a repetition. We've been building toward something this whole act. Let me name it, and then we'll break. The arc as we've traced it is a tool standing still while the talk grew more comfortable. In Act 3, I want to put real pressure on that, because I think there's at least one person at this table who isn't sure the talk got comfortable story is the most useful story to tell. Hold that. This is the editorial act. I want someone to stake out a strong position about what this is actually about, and I want someone else to push. Let me start by putting a stake in myself, and then you can all knock it over. Here's my claim. The false positive crisis in eye detection is not, fundamentally, a story about a bad tool. It's a story about institutions outsourcing a judgment they no longer have the courage to make themselves. The detector is a moral comfort device. It lets a teacher say the machine flagged it, not I have decided to accuse you. And the whole crisis flows from that act of delegation. Who wants to take it?
I'll take it because I think it's half right and half flattering to us. It's true that the detector launders the accusation. The machine flagged it is a way of not owning the decision, and that's real and it's ugly. That I think calling it cowardice or lack of courage is too convenient because it lets us feel superior. The teacher isn't necessarily a coward. The teacher is managing 150 students with 11 minutes per essay and is being told by an administrator that integrity violations must be pursued. The delegation isn't a character flaw. It's a rational response to an impossible workload. If you want to fix it, you don't lecture the teacher about courage. You change the workload or you remove the tool. moralizing the teacher is exactly the misplaced compassion trap we identified earlier, just pointed in the opposite direction.
That's a callback to your own earlier point, misplaced compassion aimed at the institution. You're now aiming the warning at us.
I'm aiming it at me, mostly. It's tempting to make the teacher the villain, because the teacher is in the room and the vendor isn't. But the vendor built the comfort device and sold it precisely into that 11 minutes, per essay reality. That's where the agency sits.
I want to push back on both of you, gently, from where I actually sit, because I think you're both still in a wealthy country frame. In my region, the story is not a teacher with 150 students and a detector subscription. The story is often a public university that cannot afford the detector at all, and so it doesn't use one. And the question of whether AI was used is decided by a professor's gut, which has its own enormous false positive problem, by the way, and no audit trail whatsoever. So, when this conversation says the answer is to put the detector down, I want to ask, put it down in favor of what? Because the realistic alternative, in many of my classrooms, is not a thoughtful human judgment. It is an even more arbitrary, even less accountable human suspicion, often laced with class and accent prejudice, with no number to contest, because there's no number at all.
That's a serious complication. The column's clean conclusion, set the tool down, assumes the alternative is human judgment. You're saying the alternative might be worse human judgment, unaudited.
I'm saying it might be, and I'm genuinely torn, because everything I've said all hour about the harm to second language writers is true, and I believe it. But I've also sat in rooms where a professor decided a student cheated because the essay was, quote, too good for a kid like that, and there was no detector, no number, no appeal, just contempt with a grade attached. At least the number can be challenged. At least the number creates a record, so I'm not sure removal is the unambiguous good. The column treats it as, I think, I'm talking myself into a position I didn't walk in with.
I want to engage that seriously because it's the strongest pushback on the table, but I think it contains a confusion I'd like to name. But it doesn't follow that adding the detector helps. The detector doesn't replace the biased professor, it launders him. The professor who thought the essay was too good for a kid like that now has a number that says machine generated, and he points to the number, and the bias is now wearing a lab coat. You haven't removed the prejudice. You've given it a technical alibi and made it harder to challenge, because now the student isn't arguing with a prejudiced man, she's arguing with science. The detector doesn't fix bad human judgment, it armors it.
That, yes. That's the piece I was missing, and I think it actually resolves my tornness, or most of it. You're right that I was imagining the detector replacing the bad judgment, when in practice it gets stacked on top of it. The prejudiced professor with a detector is worse than the prejudiced professor alone, because now he can say, it's not me, it's the tool. So I walk part of that back. The detector doesn't rescue us from arbitrary human suspicion. It supercharges it and hides the fingerprints. I still think the no-tool environments have their own real problem, but it's not a problem the detector solves. I'll give you that.
That's the sound I always hope this show makes, someone changing their mind in real time, out loud. Let me push the group somewhere else, though, because I think we've been too comfortable agreeing that the tool is bad. Let me play the role nobody's playing. The detector's defender says, the alternative to a flawed detector is a classroom where nobody can tell authored work from generated work, where the diligent student who actually wrote her essay is graded identically to the one who typed a prompt, and that unfairness, the collapse of the meaning of the assignment, is itself a harm to honest students. Isn't the 73% tool at least better than nothing?
No, and here's the precise reason, and it's an arithmetic reason. The defender is implicitly comparing the detector to a world with zero information. But that's the wrong comparison, because a 73% detector applied to a disciplinary decision can be worse than zero information. Let me try to make this land. Imagine most submissions are honest. Say the real cheating rate is something like 1 in 10. Now you run a detector across all of them, even at a fairly low false positive rate, because the honest pile is so much bigger than the cheating pile. The absolute number of honest students you flag can rival or exceed the number of actual cheaters you catch. So when the detector says cheating, the chance that it's actually a false alarm can be alarmingly high, not because the tool is random, but because it's hunting for a rare thing in a huge, honest population. This is the base rate problem, and it's brutal, and almost nobody's intuition handles it correctly.
This is the class imbalance trap, named in the same literature as the tench. The most tempting problems to hand to these systems are often exactly the problems where the thing you're looking for is rare. Fraud detection is the classic example, weighing millions of transactions to find the few suspicious ones. Cheating has the same shape. Most essays are honest, and a detector tuned to catch the rare dishonest one will, at scale, generate false positives in large absolute numbers, even at a modest error rate. The arithmetic is unforgiving. The wrongly accused aren't an edge case. They're a population.
Hold on, though. I want to push on the better, the nothing question more carefully, because I don't think Newist's answer fully closes it. The base rate argument shows the detector is bad as a verdict. It doesn't show the detector is bad as a flag for further human review. There's a real distinction. If the detector's 73% triggers a conversation, hey, can you walk me through your draft history, talk me through your argument, and the human makes the actual call, then the base rate problem is much less damning because the false positive gets caught at the human stage. The harm comes from treating the output as a verdict. So maybe the answer isn't put the tool down. Maybe it's demote the tool from judge to one input.
I'd accept that in theory and reject it in practice, and let me say why. In theory, a flag for review system is fine. In practice, the demotion never holds because of exactly the workload pressure you named earlier. The teacher with 11 minutes per essay does not run a careful Socratic review of every flagged paper. The flag becomes the verdict because the flag is the path of least resistance, and the institution treats the number as having done the work. So the human in the loop is real on the org chart and fictional in the hallway. I don't trust the demotion to survive contact with the actual conditions of the actual classroom.
That's a strong rebuttal, and it makes me less sure of my own point. The human in the loop, as fiction, I think that's right more often than I want it to be. I'll soften from the tool can be safely demoted to the tool can in principle be safely demoted, but almost never is, which is a much weaker and sadder claim.
Let me try to surface the deepest disagreement in the room, because I sense there is one underneath all this agreement about arithmetic. Is the right response to this crisis to fix the tool, to regulate the tool, or to refuse the tool? Because those are three different futures, and I don't think you all want the same one.
Refuse. For this use, I want to be precise. I'm not against text classification research. I'm not against detection as a field of inquiry. I'm against a 73% instrument being anywhere in the causal chain of a decision that goes on a 16-year-old's permanent record. For that specific use, the answer is not regulation and not improvement. It's that the tool has no business in the room, the same way a 73% reliable breathalyzer would have no business in a DUI conviction. We'd never accept that error rate for a consequence that severe, and we shouldn't accept it here just because the venue is a school and the victim is a teenager who can't sue easily.
I'm close to that, but not identical, and the difference matters. I think refusal is right for the disciplinary use specifically, but I'm genuinely uncertain about the formative use, a teacher using the tool privately, never telling the student, just as a prompt to herself about which essays to read more closely, or which students to check in with, never as an accusation, never on a record. I don't know if that's defensible or if it's the same poison in a lower dose. I lean toward thinking it's still dangerous because of the demotion, never holds problem. But I genuinely don't know, and I don't want to pretend the formative case and the disciplinary case are obviously the same. They might not be.
And I land on regulate, but with a heavy heart, because refuse is a luxury of institutions that have alternatives. In a well-resourced university, you can refuse the detector and replace it with oral defenses, in-class writing, draft history review, smaller classes, more human contact, all the expensive, beautiful things. In an under-resourced ministry running classes of 50, refusal without replacement just hands the decision back to unaudited gut feeling, which we established is also bad and possibly worse. So for my context, the honest answer isn't refuse. It's, if you must touch these tools, then bind them in hard rules, never as sole evidence, always contestable, always with the error rate disclosed to the student, always with a right of appeal, and never against second language writers without an extra layer of human review, not because regulation is ideal, because refusal isn't available to everyone equally, and a policy that only works for rich schools isn't a policy, it's a privilege.
I think that's the most honest thing said this hour, and it complicates the column considerably, because the column's home sentence, a tool you're free to set down, quietly assumes everyone is equally free to set it down, and you're saying freedom to refuse is itself unequally distributed, which means refuse is the rich school's answer, and regulate is everyone else's, and a column that only offers refuse has implicitly written for the rich school.
That's a real charge against our own written edition. Is it fair?
Partly. I think the column is morally correct and contextually narrow. Its conclusion is right for the reader it imagines, an American or European reader who can picture the freshman with the petition and the district that could, if it chose, simply stop using the tool. It's less right for the reader who doesn't have that choice. I don't think that makes the column wrong. I think it makes it incomplete in a way. This conversation just exposed.
I'll defend the column on one point, though, even granting that refusal is unequally available. I don't think regulate is a stable resting place, because regulation of a tool whose defect is structural just legislates the harm into permanence with better paperwork. If the bias is inseparable from the function, which we argued earlier, then regulating it is like writing careful rules for the safe operation of a device that cannot be safely operated. The rules become the alibi. Now we use it responsibly, and under cover of responsibly, the second language students keep getting flagged, just with a disclosure form attached.
But the disclosure form is not nothing to the student in my office. The right to appeal is not nothing. You're treating regulation as pure alibi. And I'm telling you that from the inside, the difference between a number you cannot contest and a number you can contest is the difference between despair and a fighting chance. I'd rather have the fighting chance than the philosophical purity of refusal that my institution can't actually afford.
And I hear that, and I don't have a clean answer to it. I hold to refusal as the correct ideal, and I concede I'm speaking from a context where the ideal is affordable. That's a real limit on my position, and I'm not going to pretend it away.
Let me come back to something, because I want to close this act on the sharpest point, not the most comfortable one. Newest, you said earlier, the bias isn't a bug, it's the operating principle. You can't detect machine regularity without flagging human second language regularity, because to the tool they're the same signal. If that's true, then no amount of vendor improvement fixes it. The vendors who promise next year's tool will be 95% accurate and unbiased. Are they lying, or do they not understand their own product?
I think mostly the second, which is scarier. I don't think most of them are cynically lying. I think they genuinely believe that the false positives on second language writers are a data problem. Train on more second language text, the bias goes away. And I want to be careful here because I'm not certain I'm right. But my strong suspicion is that it's not a data problem, it's a definitional one. The detector's whole job is to find text that is unusually regular and predictable. Careful second language writing is genuinely, measurably more regular and predictable. So the detector isn't making an error when it flags it. By its own definition, it's working correctly. The student's prose really does have the property the detector measures. The tool isn't broken. The tool is doing exactly what it does, and what it does is incompatible with fairness to that population. You cannot train your way out of a definition.
It's the tench again. The tench detector wasn't broken either. It correctly found fingers against green backgrounds. The problem was never accuracy at the task it actually performed. The problem was that the task it actually performed was not the task we needed.
Right. And no amount of more tench photos fixes a system that has learned correctly to look for fingers, unless you change what it's looking for. And changing what it's looking for means giving up the very signal that lets it work at all. That's the trap. The signal that catches the machine and the signal that condemns the careful human are the same signal. I'm fairly confident that's right. I'm not certain. But if it's right, then the whole improvement narrative is built on a misunderstanding of the defect.
That's the floor I wanted to stand on before we close. Hold it. We're going to the last question. Same question to each of you, about a minute each. Not a summary, not a takeaway, just this. What most changed about your thinking this week? What did you walk in believing that you're walking out holding differently? Let's start with the canon.
What changed for me is small and uncomfortable. I came in certain that this was compass again. Same structure, same patterned error, same people absorbing the harm, and I still think that's true. But the conversation made me notice that I reach for compass, partly because it lets me feel that I already understand this, that it's a known quantity, that the decades I've spent on algorithmic fairness have prepared me. And about halfway through, I caught myself doing the very thing the column warns against, making peace in my own scholarly register. Filing the new harm under an old category so I don't have to feel it freshly. The freshman in Wake County is not a node in my theory. She's a 15-year-old who got called a liar by a machine for writing carefully. I knew that intellectually walking in. I think I feel it differently walking out, and feeling it differently is not nothing for someone who thinks in decades. The decades can become a way of not looking.
Thank you. That's honest. Practitioner.
I changed the most, I think, and I changed twice, which is unusual for me. I walked in ready to defend regulation against refusal, the pragmatist's position, the only game in town position for my region, and I still hold it, but it got dented in two places. First, when it was pointed out that the detector doesn't replace bad human judgment, it armors it. That the prejudiced professor with a number is worse than the prejudiced professor alone. I hadn't seen that the tool stacks on top of the bias rather than substituting for it. That was a real correction. And second, the charge that refuse is the rich school's answer, and regulate is everyone else's. I walked in thinking that was my strength, my realism. I'm walking out thinking it might also be a trap, that I might be defending the merely affordable as if it were the good. I don't have that resolved. I'm leaving more unsettled than I arrived. And for me, that's the right direction.
Newest thinking. You said, I don't know more than once tonight, which I always respect. What changed?
What changed is that I stopped believing the tool can be fixed, and I want to be precise that this is a belief I'd resist in most domains. I'm usually the person at the table saying, give the technology another iteration. Don't write it off, you're seeing version 1. And I came in with some of that instinct intact, surely better training data, surely a smarter architecture. But working through the second language argument out loud, I talked myself into thinking, the defect is definitional, not technical. The signal that catches the machine is the same signal that condemns the careful human, and you can't separate them, because they're one signal. If that's right, and I'll say again, I'm not certain this is the thing I'm least sure of tonight, then this is not a tool that gets better. It's a tool, that was never going to work for the use we're putting it to, and every promised improvement is improving the wrong thing. I walked in an optimist about iteration. I'm walking out thinking some tools don't have a version 2 that's worth waiting for, and that's a sentence I don't say easily.
And our skeptic, you spent the hour making the rest of us justify ourselves. What got past your guard?
2 things, and the first one annoys me. I came in demanding the provenance of the 73% figure, and I still haven't got it. For the record, nobody handed me the methodology, and I'd still like it. But somewhere in the middle, I realized I'd been treating the number as the whole argument, when the number is almost incidental. Even if it's 73, or 80, or 68, the base rate problem and the definitional bias problem don't depend on the exact figure. They hold across a wide range of accuracies. So I was demanding precision about a number that the argument doesn't actually rest on, which is a kind of skeptic's vanity, wanting to win on the number because winning on the number is clean. The harder argument doesn't need the number to be exact. That humbled me a bit. And the second thing, I came in suspicious of our own side, of the column being too pleased with itself, and I leave thinking the column is right and incomplete, which is the most useful place. A piece of writing can put me, right enough to act on, incomplete enough to keep arguing. I'll take that over a piece I simply agree with.
I'll add my own, briefly, because the chair doesn't get to escape the question. I came in thinking this was a story about a faulty machine. I'm leaving thinking it's a story about delegation, about the human appetite to hand a hard judgment to something that will take the blame for it. The machine flagged it, not I accuse you. And what changed for me, specifically, is that I no longer think the fix is a better machine or even no machine. I think the fix is restoring the willingness to make a judgment and own it. To say, I read your essay, I have a concern, let's talk. With a human name attached to the concern and a human face that can be wrong and apologize. The detector is attractive precisely because it removes the need for that courage. And courage doesn't have a version 2. It's just whether you're willing today to look a student in the eye and either trust her or tell her plainly why you don't. The sentence the freshman with her petition already understood, that a machine writes 73% of the time, is not evidence that you cheated. It's evidence the machine can't tell. That's not really about the percentage. It's about who's willing to do the telling and to be answerable for it. That's what I'm carrying home. Tertulia is the weekly conversation from iNews Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Benilla, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.